Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Shelach. If you'd like to follow along, page 798. It's one of the Parshios in the book of Bamidbar, which we introduced a few weeks ago as being the book about the people, how the people were handling and coping with their new lifestyle, being the children of God, and living in very, very close proximity of the high-voltage Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, which had now descended in their midst in the Mishkan, in the Tabernacle. And we were going to learn a lot about the Torah in this book, not so much in the area of the practical commandments, the mitzvos, because there really aren't a lot of mitzvos in the book, but just about the stories and the challenges and the new situations that the Jewish people found themselves in and how they reacted to them is Torah also. What is the proper response? What is the proper Torah way of handling challenges? And there's a lot of challenges in this book. There's a lot of ups and downs, a lot of chaos almost at some points. This week, the Shelach contains the famous story, the infamous story of the 12 spies, which were sent by Moshe to the land of Israel in advance of their arrival. You know, they weren't supposed to be in the desert for very long, only a matter of days. And Moshe sent the spies, and the spies came back, all 12 of them. 10 of them came back with a foreboding report. We can't conquer it. The people are too large and too powerful. We are going to be creamed. And we would have been better off just to have stayed in Egypt. Things like that. Very, very disheartening words that broke the morale of the people. You had the other two, the remaining spies, Yehoshua and Kalev, who came back with a positive attitude, positive report. It's a beautiful land. We will take it. We will overtake it because God will be on our side. And the commentators at the very beginning are wondering and puzzled. There seems to be in Jewish tradition a kind of a criticism that the people even sent the spies, that Moshe even sent the spies. In fact, Rashi gives us a cross-reference to another version of this story, which is recounted in Devarim, the last book. The last book is Deuteronomy. It repeats. They're repeating many incidents of the Torah, and there's a different version of the way the story went, and Rashi cites it over here just so that we put the two versions together, and they're not conflicting, but they complement one another. And in the other version, it says that Moshe tells the Jewish people, "You approached me and asked, may we send spies? That was your request. You wanted to, so to speak, see it for yourself. I didn't know whether it's a good idea, whether it's not a good idea." Rashi says, the verse in Deuteronomy, Parshas Devarim, chapter 1, verse 22. "All of you approached me and said, let us send men ahead of us, and let them spy out the land, and bring word back to us, the road on which we should ascend and the cities to which we should come." Now the next verse says, "The idea was good in my eyes, so I took from you 12 men, one man for each tribe, etc." Now it sounds like, if you read that, it sounds like Moshe is saying, "I thought it was a great idea. And so I said, yeah, let's do it. Let's send the spies." Now, if you read Rashi on our Parsha, you don't get the same exact sense. Because Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, "Send forth men, if you please, and let them spy out the land." Hashem told Moshe to send the spies? And what does it mean, "if you please"? Since when does Hashem say, "Please do the mitzvah"? So it seems like the two versions conflict. Rashi resolves it by saying that first, the Jewish people came to, or representatives came to Moshe and said, "We'd like to send men before us." Moshe said, "I don't know. He was thinking. He wasn't sure if he should acquiesce. So he went to speak to the Divine Presence. He spoke to God. And Hashem responded the following. I told them that it was a good land. As it says, I will take you out of the land of Mitzrayim, etc., and bring you to a beautiful land flowing with milk and honey, and I will make sure that you settle it. I told them that it was good. Why are they asking to send men? Chayehem shani nosein lohem makom litos bedivrei hamaraglim laman lo yirashuha. Now, Rashi tells us God's reaction to the request. He says, and this is very, it's going to sound very shocking to us. Chayehem, see if we have a good translation in Rashi, in the art scroll here. Moses consulted God, who said, I have told them the land is good, but since they question me, I will let them test my veracity at the risk of being misled and losing their chance to enter the land. God was saying, I'm going to let them go, but they may be digging a grave for themselves. I'm going to let them do it. I'm going to give them a place, in literal translation, I'm going to give them a place to err, so that they will not inherit it. It almost sounds like God says, okay, if you want to be testy, let's see how you fare. I'm going to let you stumble. That's what it sounds like. Very shocking reaction. Sounds very almost vindictive. So this is what we're going to discuss today. And our guide is Rav Yerucham Lubavitch, as he has been throughout this year. His words, his timeless words that live on, and the heart and soul of his words live on in all those who study. So the question is number of things. Narrow it down to really two main questions. Question was, what was wrong with them asking for the spies? Nachmanides, adds to the question, he points out that if you read the Haftarah, there's another incident of spies in the days of Joshua, and Joshua sent spies also before they went in to conquer the land. And that was never criticized or questioned. So what was wrong with saying we want to send spies and let's get a lay of the land and plan our strategy and so on and so forth? Why was Moshe unsure, and why did Hashem seem to react that, you know, hey, they're not trusting me? So what was wrong with it? The other question is, what does God mean? I'm going to give them a place to err. I'll show them, as if to say I'm going to cause them to fall over their own footsteps. Those are the main questions that we'd like to address today. Dr. Greenberg.
The Torah says that you should not put a stumbling block before the blind. So isn't that not really fair? I mean, right. You put a stumbling block before them.
Right. That strengthens the question. I mean, if God thinks that they're going to go to the land of Israel, they're going to come back and be scared by what they see, is he not giving them a stumbling block? So here's the approach. And it's a new approach for me because I never quite understood it on the level of the Musar level, the level of character refinement that Rav Yerucham is so masterful at. He really gives us a new perspective on looking at good and evil. I think that we tend to look at the Torah as kind of black and white. There's good and there's bad. If you do good, you get rewarded. If you do bad, you get punished. How many people kind of have that paradigm etched in their mind? Raise their hand. Don't be embarrassed. We all do. Rav Yerucham kind of enlightens us based on the words of our sages, which are really quite well known, yet we don't necessarily think of it on those terms. I'll quote to you a quote from the Talmud, Kedushin, Lamed Amud Beis, 30b. Yitro shel Adam, miskaber alav bekol yom. The evil inclination within man grows stronger upon him every day. Umevake shamiso, and seeks to kill him. Does that sound shocking? If you remember, the very first Parsha class this year with Rabbi Yerucham was about the constant battle with the evil inclination. We looked at some of the verses in the first Parsha and the second Parsha. How it's always there, and we always have to be vigilant because it's always there. Remember, that goes back to the whole Jewish philosophy about how, from Lutzato, that God created a world with a balance of good and evil, and the free choice is granted, and our choice is to choose good, and thus we connect with the source of good, connect with God, and we can rightfully claim the reward of righteousness and holiness, because we had to fight to get it. So the very nature of what kind of fight it is, and what level the fight is, what intensity is something which has occupied the thinkers of Musar, particularly. Yes?
If that's the case, the Yetzer Hara, as if it grows stronger every day, is that what it says?
I believe so. I'm not 100% sure if the translation is become stronger every day, or tries to overpower him every day.
Okay.
I'm not really 100% sure.
With the idea that it grows stronger every day and the idea that it's always in balance,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that somehow the Yetzer HaTov is also growing stronger every day?
Yeah. We hope. But no, not necessarily. In other words, good choices make man stronger, bad choices make man weaker. I think we've talked about that also. And that's part of the balance, is the consequence of the choice. That if you don't choose wisely, it's going to be harder the next day. Yeah, otherwise, if you don't lose...
The opportunity for a stronger Yetzer Tov is there.
Of course.
Because of the stronger Yetzer Tov.
Correct. Right. In fact, the idea of Pesach, of liberation, is the idea that even when a person falls to the point of where he cannot get out of the battle, cannot possibly win... So then there's still a concept called redemption, that God will redeem us even from a point where we can't redeem ourselves. And that's really the point that we're going to lead to over here. So let's finish the statement of the Talmud. V'ilmole HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ozro Ein Yacholo. If not for the fact that God would help the person to overcome the evil, he would not be able to do so. Now this is news. There's a balance. It's supposed to be evenly balanced, at least at the beginning. But what the Talmud is saying is, it's not really a fair balance if left to our own devices. Yes, it's equally balanced. Yes, good can overcome evil with one special ingredient. And that ingredient is assistance from God. Okay, we have different ways of referring to that assistance. The Aramaic phrase is siyata adishmaya, the help of heaven. Be'ezrat Hashem, with the help of God. These are real, these are not just colloquialisms. These are real truisms. We don't necessarily see the inner machinations of this, but the Talmud is saying is that man can only prevail, good over evil, with this secret ingredient called Ezrat Hashem. Another phrase, which is in line with this, and I don't have the exact source quote of that, is the following. Habo l'taher misayin lo. He who seeks to become pure, they help him. They, the royal they, you know, again, this divine assistance. And one who comes to impurify himself, they open up the door for him. Those are the two. Are those two opposites? One who comes to be pure, purify himself, they help him. One who comes to be impure, they open it up for him. Does that sound like two opposites? No. Why not?
Well, in one case, they're allowing a person to do what they want. In the other, they're helping a person do what they want.
Yeah. Right. So, in the case of coming to be pure, they help. the case of coming to be impure, they don't help you become impure, but they give you an opening. They let you. What that means is that Hashem helps people become pure. He doesn't help people become impure. But he lets you become impure. What does it mean he lets you become impure?
Permits.
He doesn't stand in your way.
He doesn't. Yeah. So Rabbi Ruchem says, it's very simple. He doesn't help you to become pure. That's the opening. In other words, he leaves us to our own devices. He leaves us be. This is the same idea as it says in the Talmud, the first statement that we made, that the battle between good and evil is such that we would lose unless God helps us. So, God helping us, we can win. We have a chance. If God decides not to help us, what's going to happen? We're going to lose. That's the idea in the second statement of opening up the door. That means he removes the assistant. He says, okay, be on your own. Be on your own, you're going to lose. That's just the power of the enemy. The power of the enemy is such that we cannot win without that ingredient called divine assistance. So those are the two choices. Let's redefine our thinking. The old model is do good, get a reward. Do bad, get a punishment. New model. Come to be pure, God helps you. If God helps you, you can win. The issue is, does good prevail over evil, or does evil prevail over good? We're not interested in punishments and rewards right now. That's for another world. Here, the issue is succeeding in our struggle and our battle with good over evil. So the formula is, doesn't say do good, it says come to be pure, like take a step in the right direction, and God opens up the assistant, and you will succeed. Take a step in the other direction, and God says, okay, I'm withdrawing, go on your own, see what happens, but we know what's going to happen, because without the assistance, there's no way to win. It's not a punishment, it's a reality. We can have God's assistant anytime we want, and that will carry us the rest of the way that we need on one proviso, that we take a step to the side of purity. Just come to purify, as if that's our seek, that's our quest. All you really have to do is seek to be pure, is go in that direction rather than the other direction, and then God takes us the rest of the way. It's a powerful thing, and that's the only way. Because if we don't seek to become pure and he doesn't assist us, then we get beaten by the current. So let's reframe this whole incident of the spies. Remember, the two questions were, what was their sin? Why did Hashem get so testy? And what did he mean? I'm going to let them err. What it means is that they came to Moshe, and they had a seemingly legitimate request. Can we send spies? This is how most armies do. They send scouts. They strategize. Yehoshua himself did it. It's certainly not considered blasphemous to do something like that. And all of a sudden, you know, here we are doomed. And 10 great men, great tzaddikim, great righteous people, these were all chosen. All these 12 people were chosen. Kulam anoshim roshei b'nei Yisrael hema, the Torah says. These were all great men who were leaders of the children of Israel. And 10 of them were reduced to coming back and giving a bad report and slandering God in the land of Israel. How could they fall? So what happened was as follows. In truth, the request isn't so unreasonable. But the question is, right now the Jewish people are living in a very, very miraculous time. They have just been taken out of Egypt supernaturally. They have heard God's voice. face to face supernaturally. They have built this tabernacle in supernatural ways. They have seen the cloud of the heavenly presence right in front of them. They've seen daily miracles and so forth. They're in a miraculous time. Now, if you were in that heat of that incredible period, what step do you take? What's your first step? Do you say, God, lead us. We're following you, or do you say, we'd like to see the land first? All right. Let's not ask the question, did they make a sin or not? Let's ask a question: were they balitaher or balitame? Were they taking a step in the right direction or possibly in the wrong direction? That's really the only question. It's just a question of one step. We're not talking about blasphemers. We're not talking about evil men. We're just talking about taking the first step. Moshe heard their request. It wasn't unreasonable. He couldn't say, how dare you? He said, I don't know. Let me see what God thinks. But God's response was, very calmly, he said, I told them that it's good. I'm leading them. This trip is on me. If they want, all they have to do is follow behind me, and I will help them, and I will take them on the wings of eagles and all that good stuff and carry them into the land, and they will vanquish their enemies with a blink of an eye, because that's the assistance that I give. Sure, it's impossible to do it on your own. Of course, they're giants. But if they come with me, if they have that, elated sense that I'm carrying them supernaturally every step of the way, we'll do it, no problem. But if they want to do it on their own, if they say, we want to look at it, we want to develop a strategy, we want to, get the scope of the land and get our generals out there and our lieutenants and our colonels, everybody should be in position. He says, if they want to do it on their own, that's fine with me. But I cannot help them because they're taking a step, one step, one baby step in the wrong direction. If so, I can't help them anymore. I will let them go on their own, but you know what's going to happen. And if you wonder, how could 12 colleagues go to the same land and see the same thing, the same big fruit and the same big people, And 10 of them come back and they see horror, and the other two come back and they see greatness. It's because 10 of them apparently had this, this is very slight, but they were coming not to become purer, but becoming to take one more step to independence. And therefore, they saw Israel without that secret ingredient of the divine assistance. Moshe, Yehoshua, and Kalev, they fought internally very hard. They prayed. They realized that there's this great struggle of us, trying to become independent and yet knowing that the struggle is great. They prayed. They tried very hard to not let go of that pure motive. And therefore, they had the divine assistance, even in the way they in their perception, and they came back with a different perspective. So this is what's at stake. We're not talking about what seems to be evil, but that's not material. The only thing that matters in life is which way are we taking our step? Are we stepping to come more pure, closer? Realizing that, no, the task is too great for us on our own. But if we step in the right direction, God helps us. Or are we stepping the other way? One baby step the other way, in which case we may very well lose that assistance. And then on our own devices, there's no way to win. Yes?
All right, Goldberg, I guess this is 3,000-something hundred years later in their defense.
Oh, you're going to defend them?
I want to talk to Jewish people.
Yeah.
In terms of, okay, we were at Har Sinai, and we said Nasa v'nishma. And these formerly slaves at the bottom of the level of Tumah, etc., realized that was a good thing. Hashem gave them the Torah. And then we see that they have all the Torah, and they have this relationship with Hashem, and they're like, it's like, you know, even with Hashem b'simcha, we gave up the slave master in Egypt, and we have now as we're servants of Hashem. And so, realistically speaking, they see that he feeds us man. It may not be exactly the same flavor and everything, and he takes us through, and we have all these responsibilities now.
Right.
So now we're at the border, and he says, okay, now you're going to go into this land. And so the Jewish people, like, maybe got a little bit, I don't want to say smarter, but a little bit more cautious. Let us first see, you know, what we're getting into, you know, before we agree, and then maybe we look what happens if once we agree and then we say no, look, Hashem punishes us, gets mad at us because we agreed. So before we agree, let's take a look. So I'm not saying that they're evil. I'm saying that they're being cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And then they send these spies in, and these spies become, let's say some of the great tzaddikim become a little bit weak-hearted. They say, Hashem's going to give us this land, but we're going to have to fight these monsters,
mm-hmm.
these giants,
mm-hmm.
and all these things, and maybe we there's a way out. Maybe we could, like, live here, on this side of the river.
Right.
So I'm trying to look at it as not evil. I don't want to judge these people as,
right.
you know, and thinking that maybe they learned a little bit, which made them cautious, which, again, angered Hashem, because Hashem wants us to blindly, you know, he says, I'm going to take you into this land, then we should know better. You know, that should be enough for us. But maybe the human side of them, the fear side, they've experienced Egyptians with a lot of power also, and they felt like...
Okay, that's fine. And our whole point was to say that they don't seem to be committing an evil act.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is not good versus evil, necessarily. The question is, do you want to take the route of siyata dishmaya, mm-hmm. of divine assistance, which is primarily requires a sense of coming closer to God,
mm-hmm.
a step closer, and then meriting his assistance, or do we want to take one step the other way, more independent? Because you can only step one way at a time. You can't step, take one step this way and one step that way at the same time. Your legs don't spread that wide.
What was that neutral step? Is there such a thing as a neutral step?
That's a good question. There's a good question whether there's such a thing in the spiritual realm as just standing still. That's a very interesting philosophical question.
So you're told that the sea, stand still and you'll see the salvation of the
Yeah. Yeah. That may have been stand still physically and take a leap spiritually.
Yeah.
So, but I think that the case has been made by people before me that really in spirituality there's no such thing as standing still.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're choosing, you may say it's not evil. Okay, fine. But which way are you choosing?
Mm-hmm.
Are you choosing the path with divine assistance or the path without divine assistance? And if you choose the path without divine assistance, you could smugly say, well, I'm not an evil person, but don't expect that God is going to perform the miracle and to allow you to succeed in the impossible. You're going to find yourself up against the impossible. And it even affects our ways of looking. It even affects our eyesight. If you take the path of divine assistance, you will see things differently. Things will seem surmountable. If you take the path without divine assistance, then it will seem insurmountable. And it all depends on that one leaning, that one inclination. Yeah.
You know, one question seems to be, what was their motive then? I mean, if they wanted to spy out the land in order to conquer it with Hashem's help, that would be a positive thing. I mean, you do have to spy. But why would Joshua send spies to
yeah.
Jericho if you're just going to walk around at 7
right.
blow the chauffeur and the walls sink into the ground? What do you
right.
need to spy it out for, right?
Right.
So you do militarily need to find out, you know.
Right.
You're still going to have to fight it, et cetera. If they're going to spy it out to decide whether or not they want to go, that's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So good question. I thought about this myself. How did we answer the question about why did Joshua do it and that was okay and Moshe does it and it's not okay?
Depends on your motive.
So I think that what Yerucham says is that the climate of the times were different.
Mm.
When Moshe was alive, they were still living in the in the miraculous atmosphere. They were still in the wake of the Exodus, which they had already experienced. It was no endeavor on their part at all. And when Moshe passed on and Joshua began to lead the people, there was a noticeable difference in the climate.
Different people.
Different people. And then it was considered to be normative and desirable for the people to be a little bit more active in their own destiny. So I guess the reason why it may have been considered the wrong step was because they were still living in the Moshe era. In the Moshe era, God felt that they should have still felt that that God was carrying them, and to ask to be more independent was inappropriate for that, for who they were and what they had been through.
For this week's Rabbi Wein's Torah, email Torah commentary, suggested, yeah, they had just been slaves. A slave does not have to make any decisions for himself. He does whatever the master tells you. The master gives him some food, tells him what to do, etc. And now they're out on a desert. Food comes down from the manna comes down from the sky. They're told wherever to go. Their clothes don't get old, and their shoes don't get old on their feet, etc. Water follows them around in the desert.
Right. Okay?
If they actually have to go into the land, they're going to have to start working for themselves.
Yeah.
And so they're actually afraid of doing that. They still have the slave mentality. They're, they are being carried all through the wilderness, and they don't want to necessarily have to do things for themselves.
And it was a gradual transition. The Jewish people were really struggling with exactly when to make the break.
Well, it would have been all of a sudden transition.
Yeah, I mean, we find, for example, not so sudden, though, because we find that in the days of Samuel the prophet, the Jewish people came forward and asked for a king. And that incurred the wrath of God. And that's difficult to understand because the Torah itself talks about coming into the land of Israel and asking for a king. So what was wrong with their question? So it's a big discussion amongst the commentators, but one of the approaches is that it was still too early. Even in under the leadership of Joshua, Joshua had been the right-hand man of Moshe. He had lived in his tent, and he had observed, and he had received every word of Torah from him, and there were still miracles occurring during the lifetime of Joshua. And perhaps it was still immature. They were still making that break into more autonomy and independence too early. So even after they came into the land, it was still nebulous whether they are supposed to get involved in more independence or stay a little bit, being carried. So it's something that they struggle with and something that we struggle with. Every Jew has to really come to the hishtadlus and bitachon quotient. How much hishtadlus, how much human endeavor versus how much reliance upon God. And in our lifetime, in this stage, in the exile and so forth, it's quite clear that we have to be involved in hishtadlus, that we have to be involved in human action and human endeavor. But the requirement to rely on God never changes. It's just in terms of how much outward involvement we play. So it becomes, as we move on in time through the exile, this question doesn't really work itself out. It's an ongoing struggle. How much independence, how much activity, how much endeavor on my part, at the same time maintaining my reliance upon God. This, you could argue that what's going on over here is really setting the stage for all of time. But what we understand from Rav Yerucham in this parsha is that man is not measured by big monumental decisions all the time, but by little gestures and by leanings and by inclinations. We also know that it really depends very much on that leaning, on that inclination, as to whether we will merit the divine assistance, which is the key to success and survival, or whether we, God forbid, will be left on our own devices, which could end up in disaster. This is really the main point that is brought out over here. Yes.
The two that came back with the positive outlook, it seems as if they changed their mind or they became trusting in Hashem. Therefore, Hashem was being more
supportive to them.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, am I...
Yeah, that's correct. Are you wondering why those two, rather than the others, why did they get it right and the other ones kind of missed the mark? It's
and
a good
what
question.
Happened next?
What happened next was that the 10 were killed in a plague. And because every single Jewish male over the age of 20 bought into the negative report, without exception, it was decreed that they would not enter into the land. Only those younger than 20 and the women did not buy into the negativity. But the two survivors, I don't know about the Levim, good question. I don't recall hearing anything about the Levim, that they were spared, the older generation. I don't think so. Only those two men, Kalev and Yehoshua, were the only two that got to cross over the Jordan River. Only ones. Yeah.
So we can have second chances, can't we? Maybe, a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if we know we're doing something wrong, kind of
right.
In the back of our minds, and we...
Right. Always, whenever we have our faith, let's always just try to, we don't might know all the right answers, just try to lean a little bit more to the side of purity. That's what Rabbi Yerucham says. Just come to purify. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, because I haven't read the parsha, didn't Moshe bless Yehoshua and even change his name or something, add a letter, because Moshe knew that he would be faced with the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It says that Moshe changed Hoshea's name to Yehoshua, mm-hmm. adding a yud to his name, which represented a prayer. May God spare you from the counsel of the other spies. Why would Moshe show favorites? Just to conjecture, Yehoshua was his trusted servant and student. And he just had that better connection with him, and reciprocated that. As far as Kalev, the other one, who came with a positive report, it says that when they arrived into the land of Israel, he doesn't say his name, but Rashi proves that it's him. Kalev ran to Hebron, and he went to the burial site of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. And he prayed with all of his heart and all of his soul not to succumb to the counsel of the other spies. And that's how he was able to maintain his positive and his pure outlook. But the other ones, and we're talking about great people who didn't really do anything, quote, bad, but even great people who are not constantly pushing to the side of purity are going to find that when they need that assistance, it might not be there. Steve?
I understood that 10 spies were swayed more by ego than anything else because they were afraid that things were going to be too well if they went into the promised land and had full faith, and that they would lose some of their authority, and they were unsure of their position for the future.
That's another well-known explanation. It's, you know, probably a whole different approach to this incident. Yeah, there may be another approach to it. Yeah.
Was it these guys that approached Moshe, or was it the Jewish people that approached Moshe to send spies, and he picked these guys out?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like they volunteered for the job with a negative attitude.
That's right. That's right. In fact, Moshe chose the best man because he was hoping that the best would have the best chance of remaining pure. And in spite of that, they still, you know, definitely Moshe gave him the best possible advantage. And, you know, also the Ramban discusses why Moshe didn't just say no. I think he says that if he would have nixed it, then there may have been an uprising, because the people maybe couldn't handle that approach. They were too antsy, and they needed to take that step of independence. So Moshe had to really be a very strong politician. And without saying no, plus the other thing is, if he says no, they might lose faith even greater, because they'll say, what, are you hiding something? Mm-hmm. You don't want us to see it. So Moshe had to play a real, you know, a politician, a diplomat. And he said okay, but then he did the control on who he sent, and he literally took the best. But there's no guarantees.
That's what was irritating God, because he felt that, you know, they should have had faith that after all he's demonstrated by splitting the sea and taking them out of Egypt and all the numerous miracles, and now they don't believe him.
Right. It's not that they don't believe. It's not black and white. We're changing. We're trying to change our outlook. It's not, you know. I'm a good guy, I'm a bad guy. It's all shades. It's all inclinations. It's all which way are we pushing ourselves? Are we, you know, we're not good cop, bad cop. Yeah.
Can I just say, is it the end of this week's Haftorah when the angel shows up to tell Joshua what he should do, or is that
in the Haftorah? It should be.
If one standing question, why does the angel tell him to take the shoe off of his foot?
Only one.
Yeah. That's Raglecha.
Raglecha rather than Raglecha, yeah.
Which will be Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, take off the shoes and off your feet.
Yeah, I remember studying about this. I don't remember. No, Moshe was approached by an angel, told to take the shoes off of his feet.
The burning bush.
Joshua was approached and told to take the shoe off of his foot. So why the difference? And it may have something to do with a different era, a different level of intensity. If I recall, but
I have a couple ideas.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You just came from a Kalitza ceremony. You only have your shoe still on. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
And if you believe that one, I'll tell you another one.
Angels.
He's just pulling our leg.
Angels only have one foot. They cannot conceive of anybody
having
two shoes.
Very good. Okay. Yeah.
Good question. What is it about the giants? You know, we saw ourselves as grasshoppers, I think the commentary was, and they're giants. What is it about seeing our enemy as giants and seeing a lot of death? Because they said there was also so much death in the land. Because obviously Hashem was killing them to keep them busy so they wouldn't notice us when they... That's what I learned.
Right.
So what we have to learn something from this.
Mm-hmm.
To see an enemy that's superior, thing we think is unbeatable, for instance, like let's say modern-day Israel, we look around and we always worry about the enemies look unbelievable. They're going to be.
Right.
And then the death that we see dying, that we question what is Hashem's involvement in the world. There's something to learn in here for us, because we got punished by seeing those two things and not saying no matter what, we're still okay.
Well, put it this way. Based on this formula about how we cannot win the war without Hashem's assistance, we should assume that it's going to look insurmountable. We shouldn't assume anything else. If we think that we can beat them on our own devices, we're in trouble. Because then we're saying we can go without heavenly assistance. And that's really the step in the wrong direction. So that should be the norm. That's what you should expect, is that it should be impossible. And then what we say is, everything's impossible without Hashem's assistance. That should be a natural reaction. And if we say, and we don't have to solve all that, we have to just say, let's step in the right direction. We will merit this assistance, and then we can really do the impossible and do the insurmountable. And it's not considered to be reckless as long as we are, you know, doing the appropriate steps necessary on our level, and at the same time remembering that God is behind us. And this is not just a formula for wars. This is a formula with the internal battle, the internal battle with evil and good. This is not just, it shouldn't be just taken as a war strategy story. This is primarily a story of the battle within man, the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful Shabbos.